Welcome back to Beyond Well. I'm Sheila Hamilton, and this is a program for people who want to learn more about our interior lives. And our next guest is someone that I think you are going to find endlessly fascinating. Dove Barron has dedicated his life to codifying how we apply meaning to any given situation. He's the preeminent expert on emotional source code, and he facilitates a unique understanding and accelerates individuals and organizations to experience deep, meaningful, fulfilling, purpose-driven experiences. Dove is the creator and host of two popular podcasts, Leadership and Loyalty and Curiosity Bites. As a speaker, Dove has had the honor of presenting to so many prestigious audiences, but it was Dove's interest in both psychology, neurology, psychology, human behavior that preempted my interest in having him on the show. I wanted to know, what is it that drives Dove Barron, and how does he actually deal with some of the regular negative thoughts that all of us face, even when he does so much work? This is going to be a fascinating conversation with a man who I have come to respect and a podcast I have come to put on my preeminent playlist. Hi, Dove. It's good to see you.
Well, that's very kind of you. Thank you. I'm honored to be here. I think this is going to be a pretty inspiring conversation.
I have never met anyone who shares so many of my passions, both for neurology, for psychology, for personal improvement. And you have been one of the few that I think has put it into a business model that I'm completely in awe of. First of all, I want you to explain to people how you structure your days around all of these varied interests. Just give people a day in the life of Dove.
Starts early. It starts early, and I have my morning rituals, and my morning rituals are like a little bit of Celtic salt, then a liter of water, those kinds of things. Then there's my ginger and lemon juice, pure, and then
love it.
Coffee and with fats and butter and all that kind of stuff. And then I fast most of the rest of the day. There's an exercise program. There's a meditation program. There's journaling. And there's at least minimum 1 hour of studying a day to try and study the different areas that I study, and at least bare minimum an hour, but often 4, 5, 6 hours of writing. And then there's working with my clients and recording my podcast, The Dove Barron Show. So there's a lot. Oh, and by the way, I'm also married and have a wife and have children and grandchildren. And I do actually spend time with them too.
Yeah, you have real life. I suspected as much, Dove, because it's clear to me that you are maximizing your potential for your time here on Earth. What is the urgency that sets people like you apart from people who sleep in, they've hit snooze 5 times, they have no interest in what's coming next for their personal lives? What do you think is the defining difference between someone like yourself and these other people that I see who are suffering so much?
It's a great question. And I don't think anything really ever has one answer, but at a simple level, it is an urgency to serve. That's what gets me out of bed every morning, is the urgency to serve, to touch a life, to make a life, quote, better in some way, shape, or form, is on one side of it. On the other side of it is my religion is curiosity. So I'm deeply, deeply curious all the time. And I wake up curious. I go to sleep curious. So the curiosity combined with the desire to serve is what drives everything in me from a place of my own subjective purpose.
Where did the purpose come from? At what stage of your life that Dove Barron would be a better person if he were serving others rather than serving his own ego or serving his bank account?
Sure. I think it started in massive dysfunction, as it usually does. And that was in trying to serve my mother. My mom was bipolar for most of my childhood. And so my job was to take care of her, to serve my siblings. I was the eldest kid, so I was taking care of everybody. I made my mom laugh. I was good at making her laugh. She used to describe me as saying, oh, this is Dove. He's my wonder child. He cleans, he cooks, he takes care of his siblings, but he also makes me laugh, and he's my counselor. So I was spousified. You know, I was in a completely emotionally inappropriate relationship with my mom. I didn't have my childhood. So serving, really, it's not serving in the way I would define it today, but servitude was put upon me And that has evolved, particularly after 1990, into becoming, well, what does it mean to really serve as opposed to being servitude, which was actually an evolution out of my ego. Not that I'm over my ego by any stroke of the imagination, but.
Well, and also, you know, what you're describing is so common for eldest siblings who are still in trauma response. And yep. It sounds like you made the shift that you were able to say, I'm no longer doing this for the approval and the love of my parent. I'm now doing it for my own personal reasons. But take people through that transformation, because that involves a hell of a lot of work for most people.
It does. I asked my doctor that if I could see a therapist. Now, you should know that I was born in a ghetto in abject poverty, surrounded by crime and violence and addiction and all kinds of major dysfunction. So for somebody to ask to see a psychiatrist or a counselor of their doctor, the doctor said to me, are you depressed? And I was like, no. I went and saw this doctor. Her name was Dr. Dick. I will never forget.
So good.
That was her name.
So good.
Stuck with me all those years. But she first thing she said to me, why are you here? Are you depressed? And I was like, no. Mm-hmm. I just want to know if there's something more than this. This doesn't make sense. So that desire was in me from me being about 7 years old was when I had a spiritual awakening. And that desire never went away. But the transformation took place in 1990. Mm-hmm. So I'd already been on my journey. So by 1990, you know, I'd already done 20 years of therapy. Mm. I'd been to all the workshops. I'd studied with different spiritual masters from around the world. I studied Vedanta and Buddhism and the Tao and Gnostic and Coptic Christianity and Kabbalah and all these, as well as Jungian psychology. And then in June 1990, I was an adrenaline junkie and had been for many years. I reached for a rock. That rock dislodged and it sent me hurtling down onto the boulders below from 120 feet. I got smashed to pieces. And so did life as I knew it at that point. And my ego, like people say, well, that must have changed you. And I said, no, it didn't change me at all. It embedded me, because my ego was, I'm resilient. I'm a survivor. Mm-hmm. So when people say, how are you doing? I'm great. I'm coming back. Because if I came from that environment that I just described, and I'd been a boxer, and I'd been a martial artist, and I'd been a bodybuilder, and I'd built businesses on three continents, you're not knocking me down. I'm getting up. So I had this stupid idea. And it might offend some people here, because I would brag about being resilient. Resilience is stupidity. It means you get knocked down 7 and get up 8, but you don't bother to wonder why I've been knocked down. Stupid people are resilient. I was incredibly stupid. Mm. Instead of get knocked down 1, stay down and go, well, why am I on my ass here? What's going on? Let me work that out. And so that fall did that for me. Initially, it embedded me in the ego, and I kept saying, I'm great, I'm coming back. And as you and I know, there is no back. Everything in life is forward. And so I stopped. And there was a very, very dark night of the soul. And I suddenly realized that I was still trying to save people. That I was still acting out of that child that I'd been. I was still fulfilling my emotional source code that was driving my ego identity, which was I was the savior and I could get applause. And I decided that I would no longer be saving anybody, that there was nobody to save except for myself. And from there, I moved into service. That was the shifting point.
It almost to a T, the people that I talk with that have truly made great transformation in their life after extreme trauma have taken a period off from their former grind, off from their former gifts that were given them, off from the former doing, and really focused on being. If it was only 6 minutes and it seemed like 6 years, they did it. They actually had that come to the realization that they could not continue in the way that they'd been doing it prior. I'm curious if you think there's a way to get around that. Do you believe that you must do that? Humiliating, so vulnerable, so painful work, or can we get out of it with just an easier path?
It's a great question. I know that you've been through your own journey, and I know that many people will recognize their own journey as they're listening to us. But the truth of the matter is, as I say to people, my fall was literal. I fell off a mountain, but we all fall. So sometimes that fall is a horrible diagnosis or a heart attack or a death of a loved one or a bankruptcy or something punches us in the ego and makes us stop. But you have to remember, and this is really important for people, please stop trying to kill your ego. it helped you survive. My ego was very, very strong. I mean, I still have one, but it was very strong because it helped me survive. And that doesn't make it a bad thing. That makes it a good thing. Allowing it to drive the bus is a bad thing. And as a result, the people I work with are incredibly successful. And I believe every one of them that I've experienced so far is driven by some form of trauma. And so we're out in the world trying to reach these goals, these aspirations, this thing that will fill the hole in my soul. And then it doesn't. So maybe it must be something bigger until something makes you have a fall and you wake up and you go, this game isn't working. Now, what do most people do? They say, you're right. I've had a heart attack. I've missed my kids. I've missed my anniversaries. And then 3 months later, they're back on that same path.
That's right.
Because that ego thing allowed them to survive. It's not a bad thing. It allowed them to survive. But confronting that dark night of the soul is the most difficult. It's difficult for people who have nothing, but it's incredibly difficult for people who have a lot.
Yeah.
Because when you have a lot, then you are giving up what you believe is a reputation. And what you're doing is actually giving up an identity. And the number one addiction of human beings, all human beings, is our addiction to our identity.
Yeah.
We will die for that shit. We will strap a bomb on ourselves and blow ourselves up for the identity of I'm this. As opposed to saying, what if I'm not? What else could I be? And my analogy is you are a multifaceted diamond.
Yeah.
But you've polished a particular facet that the world applauded, that keeps you distracted from the parts of yourself you've disenfranchised. But when you look at those parts, when you go into those, you don't get less powerful, you get more powerful, but the focus is different.
I would say that most of the people that I work with are extremely successful, highly intelligent, very driven business people who are now moving into the stage of their life where just by nature of their age, their status, they need to be doing something different. And man, the clawing to the past identity is so ferocious that it sometimes scares me that that's all that they have driven to, that they haven't driven to spirituality, that they haven't driven to other places to be or people to be, that there's no curiosity about the beauty that lies before them. It's all in the past. I'm surprised by it, frankly.
Yeah. But again, I used to be really surprised by it, but I have such deep compassion for it now because I see it completely as a survival mechanism. And so the analogy I use to people all the time is your boat went down and you're clinging to a piece of wood and you've been clinging to that piece of wood for 3 days and it saved your life, that piece of wood. And I come along with a boat and I say, hop on, I'll save you. And you're like, I can't let go of this piece of wood.
Yeah.
And I'm like, it's much safer here. We're going to get where you want to go. It's going to be healthy. It's going to be, no, I'm not letting go of this piece of wood. Could you tow me? I'm willing to go somewhere, but not letting go of what it was. And this is what it is. And so the game is I'm serving by doing, clinging to this old identity, but it's not really serving. It's servitude. And you're in servitude, not even of your history, but of the ego's idea of what it takes to survive. And that is so profound awakening for people.
Yeah, it's so
because
real.
The challenge is if you don't do that, what will happen? And I know I've seen this too, and you probably have too, is okay, I've got it. You know, we've sold the business. I've got $1 billion in the bank. It's fantastic. I bought myself a new Rolex and a new Ferrari. I bought the wife a new set of upper lungs. I've traded my bride in, you know, something like that. Bought another house, bought an island, whatever it is. And you're right. Okay, that's done now. So now they become the philanthropist. It's just another identity. Or they become this spiritual person. You know, they're doing the eat, pray, love thing. And I was like, you've done the same thing. You've just traded badges. As opposed to seeing yourself as whole, you've now found another facet to polish and ignored all the other stuff. And you know as well as I do that diving into that, what feels terribly fearful is where the gifts are. The treasure you seek is hidden in the cave you fear to step into. That's the beauty. That's the magnificence. Your light, your eyes will adjust to that darkness and you will see treasure you could never have seen. Don't trade one identity for the other, because I see that happening all the time with the kinds of people that you and I serve. It's like, well, see, I'm not that anymore. Now I'm
totally.
So I want to talk to you about your work on the shadow self and your darkest side. How Did you confront it? Where does it lie? And when does it come back up for you?
I'm constantly confronting it. Where does it lie? About there, like right in front of my eyes all the time. You can't hide from your ego. So it's really important to understand and give it context that it was there to help me survive. It's done a fantastic job. And I have to just move it out of the driver's seat, because it will sit in the passenger seat and it will navigate for me if I let it. But sometimes, because it's been in control for so long, it wants to be the backseat driver, and I have to lock it in the trunk occasionally. Like, shut up. This is not for you. I'm okay. But I want to thank it. I give it a name. My ego's name is Dave. And the reason it's Dave, I'll tell you why it's Dave, is because if I'd have stayed in the country I was born in, if I'd have stayed in the environment I was born in, I would have become Dave. I would have become that person. I do a lot of stuff around quantum physics and multidimensional reality. So every decision is a new dimensional reality. And so there's a Dave who didn't make the decisions I made to move away. He became more English in his name. He drinks too much.
He only
does coke on the weekends, but the weekend is Thursday to Sunday. He pulls around in his relationship. He's miserable, and he's not a very nice person.
Wow, how interesting.
I keep him right here. I keep him, every decision I make, is this a decision for Dave or is this a decision for me? Wow. And Dave is actually my catalyst to take being courageous in serving and being kinder, being more compassionate, in being curious, because Dave's none of those things. Dave's very self-protective. So I'm dancing with that dark part of myself every day, and I actually enjoy it. I'm invigorated by it, because he's loud sometimes, and he's only loud because he's scared.
Yeah.
And so for me, that's how I manage this part of myself, rather than pushing it away. But the other part of this shadow self, and I think this is where people forget, is we think of the shadow self as containing the dark parts, the Dave. But here's the thing. In order for you, me, us, to survive, there were parts of yourself you had to disenfranchise. And that might have been your spirituality. That might have been your creativity. That might have been your physicality. It could have been anything.
I think for women, a lot of times it's their femininity.
Right. You had to disenfranchise that part.
Yeah.
You know, when Hillary Clinton was running, and I said, she's never going to become president. People were like, why? And I said, because she's a man. And people went, what do you mean? She has lived so long in that man's world that she has disenfranchised her femininity. So she has no appeal to men, and they don't respect her. And she has no appeal to women. She's lost that. That's what's missing. She didn't keep that. And so that was an example of disenfranchised. If she'd have brought that part back to herself, she would have done much better. It plays out politically. It plays out in leadership. It plays out all over the place. We disenfranchise these parts of ourselves that don't take away from us. They did. So in order for Hillary Clinton to survive in her early days, I know she had to do that. I get that. But ultimately, it became her demise.
Yeah.
And I find that all the time with these very high-powered leaders. The thing that they're running away from is actually brought them down. And it's the thing that they actually need to embrace.
Yeah.
Because it actually enriched them.
I love how your day vacillates between thinking about the mind, thinking about the spirit, thinking about the brain, because there's so much discussion between neurologists versus spiritual people who believe that we are essentially matter and we are all bouncing around against one another with our energies. And I'm so curious, Dove, how you see this argument between science, spirituality, and who we truly are as human beings to one another and what we owe one another. I love the debate because everybody is in their corner saying this part of us is more powerful, when I just see it as one big dance party, everyone under the tent together. And that until we understand how critical each of these pieces are to our mortality, that we won't actually solve the puzzle, or at least the hardest puzzles that are before us.
Yeah. See, for me, I think that it's part of this fractional thinking that we've been brought into reductionistically, rather than looking at things from a quantum field position. And so from a quantum field position, so let's just take this for a minute. You and I are talking to each other over Zoom. We're in different countries.
Yeah.
And I can hear you in this moment, and you can hear me in this moment. I can see you in this moment. You can see me in this moment. This is impossible as little as 40 years ago.
Yeah.
So here's the analogy I give people all the time. I want you to imagine all the scientific knowledge in the world in 1904.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, 1904. Think about all the scientific knowledge in the world. How big is that circle dimensionally? Let's say, you know, that it's a circle of about a foot, right?
Yeah.
Okay, great. How big, right, was that circle in 1600?
Mm-hmm.
They go, well, maybe 6 inches. Great. Yeah. So what was the other 6 inches in 1600? And they go, I don't know. Well, it was mystical. It was occult. It was woo-woo, all that. Mm-hmm. Say, now let me ask you a question. In 2024, how big is the circle? Oh, well, it's much bigger. Now it's 2 feet. Mm. Right. So what was in the foot between 1904 and 2024 in that 120 years? Well, that was all mystical. Right. So how big is the circle in 100 years from now? So you're making things as not real because we don't have the equipment to measure it.
Mm.
That's the only distinction, is the equipment to measure it. So we can measure quantum fields now. This is stuff I was studying in the 80s when people thought I was a nut job because I was talking about quantum fields. I was talking about multidimensional reality. Mm-hmm. And I was talking about how that we have personal emotional resonance fields, and your field pulls you to me, and my field pulls me to you. And if there's a match in those fields, we'll work together. And if there's not, we'll rub up against each other. And if my ego is controlling that field and you feel like a match, I'll push you away. Like, this is not theory. This is now quantum physics. I'm speaking at a neuroscience conference this week. I'm speaking in neuropsychiatry. I'm not a neuropsychiatrist, but I'm speaking to these people and they're inviting me to speak to them about things that are completely outside of their world that they'll be talking about in a year or two. So this argument isn't an argument. It's a limitation.
I love that framing. I'm going to remember to use that framing from now on. That's a limitation.
It's not an argument. It's a limitation.
Mm-hmm.
It's a conceptual limitation.
Yeah.
The argument between particle physics, traditional physics, and quantum physics during the Copenhagen conference it's not possible because this is the truth, traditional physics. Well, then Einstein said, well, maybe, and he was against it, and Heisenberg came along, and Niels Bohr, and a bunch of others. And now, you know, the whole idea of string theory was completely wackadoo.
Yeah.
And now there isn't a university, any good university on the planet that doesn't have a string theorist.
That's right.
So what happened? When did it go from wackadoo to science? When did that happen?
Yeah, well, limitations lifted. Yeah.
Exactly.
That's fantastic.
And all that is that we've got to understand that it's not an argument, it's a perception.
Mm.
So it's like, let's get out of the confines. Hold on a second. What's outside of the confines? Oh, you're a Muslim and I'm a Christian. That's so different. Is it really? Do you want to think about that for a minute? Because you're both inspired by Abrahamic religions. Abraham had two wives. His second wife was Zara, and she gave birth to Muhammad. Oh, well, who was she married to? She was married to Abraham, father of the Jewish faith. Oh, maybe we're a lot more similar than we think. We don't bother looking past the surface in anything. So I look at you and I go, oh, well, you're wearing a red hat and I'm wearing a blue hat. Clearly we're different. Oh, hold on a second. Where are we the same?
Mm.
That's the distinction we got to look for. That's where we come together. That's where we bond.
I wanted to allow you to dip into that because I've been loving listening to your podcasts at DoveBaron.com. And I have really thought so many of the people in our audience would really enjoy jumping over, delving deeper into some of these philosophical, psychological, theoretical conversations that you have because they're high level. They do not cheat people's intelligence, which I really appreciate. And I really believe that so many people in our audience would love learning more about your guests. So tell them a little bit more about your show, Dove.
That's very kind of you. Thank you, Sheila. It's the Dove Baron Show. You can find it on Apple or wherever you listen to podcasts, of course. It's also on YouTube. The shows are broken up into half-hour shows, approximately half-hour shows. But many of them are 3 episodes long, so an hour and a half, whatever it is. And we have on this week, I've had on one of my heroes. You know, you say you shouldn't meet your heroes?
Mm-hmm.
This week, released
you did.
Is one of my heroes, James Burke. And I describe him as the godfather of my curiosity. You heard me say earlier, curiosity is my religion. He's the godfather of it. I told him this. It was like so exciting because when I was a kid, there was a show on TV, like when I was a young teenager, called Connections. And he showed the connection between this thing and that thing. And it was in obscure areas. Mm. And that's what made me into a polymath, him. So I got to interview him in his 80s while he was in France. And he's like sharp as a razor, an incredible memory. So it's people like him. It's people like Dr. Azra Raza, who is the leading oncologist in the world in leukemia. Perry Marshall talking about conscious virology, how viruses have consciousness, not intelligence, not a brain, but intelligence. Theologians, some of the most famous theologians in the world, people who've debated people like Christopher Hitchens, and then people like Paul Anderson, who you know, we both know, famous artists and singers and athletes, and many CEOs and leaders and people who are running for president. We've done all those kinds of shows. And it's always about, well, let's just get below the surface here. Mm. Like I just interviewed the guy who was the producer of a movie called Sound of Freedom. You may know it.
Oh, yeah.
It was the number one independent movie of 2023 that Hollywood snubbed, that everybody snubbed because it was about child sex slavery.
Yeah.
It's a very iffy subject. It's an important subject, one that I've been talking about for 20 years. And people are like, you knew about this? Yes, I did. So this is an important thing. It was close to my heart because of that. I went through that, some of that experience as a child. Mm-hmm. So the vastness of these conversations and the depth of them is deeply fulfilling. And my wife gets to edit them. And she and she said to me, oh my God, that was such a good conversation. And she said, I'm sick of hearing you, but they had good things to say.
No. Do you know what I really do appreciate about it, Dev? And I think that if you listen to the mainstream media and you listen to media reports, that analysts want you to believe that people have lost their attention span and that they no longer enjoy in-depth, deep conversation. And I think that programs like yours have shown unequivocally that that is so far from the truth. I think the hunger is actually deeper now because people are being fed all of this other crap, 15, 10, 5 second pieces all day long. They're hungry for deep conversation.
I think people want the snippets. I get that. I want the snippets too, but there's no satiation in that.
Yeah.
That's a bag of chips. That's not a meal.
Right.
And so if you look at Joe Rogan, whether you like Joe or not, Lex Fridman, you look at these people, these are long form podcasts.
Yeah.
And they're doing much better than the short form 10-minute ones.
Yeah.
Why? Because as you said, I think there is a big audience for those short form people, just they don't have time. Okay, I get that. But the people who are 45 plus, I think they're like, where did my shows go? Where did where did the depth go? Mm. Like they missed the John Pilgeners of the world, who I, again, was one of my heroes who died. Unfortunately, I didn't get to talk to him, but he was one of the great journalists who passed. And he used to do long documentaries about Vietnam and about Pol Pot and about all these depths that you could dive into. I think that you're absolutely right. There's still a hunger for that. Mm. And I hunger for it. And I love being in there. And
you
just
too.
Love getting in there. I know you do too. And it's like in our conversations off air, you know, it's like, let's go deeper down this rabbit hole. We, you know, between the two is going to pull each other out of the rabbit hole.
Well, I appreciate somebody that I can be down there with, you know, I really do. DoveBaron.com is where you can find all the information about Dove. Again, on Apple, Spotify, anywhere you listen to podcasts, you can find his Dove Baron podcast as well. And I so thank you for joining us, Dove. It's been really, really wonderful.
I love speaking to you too. And thank you so much for inviting me to be of service to you and to the audience. And anybody who wants to reach out to me, you can feel free to do that. I know I'm insane. My private email is dove@dovebaron.com. You can write to me. I want to know what you got out of it. And the other thing I want to say to you is this before I go. Listen, I have a podcast. I've had a podcast for 16 years. I know it's a one-way street. So what I mean by that is Sheila's doing a show. She brings you amazing guests. I know that. I've been through the list. She does the research. She brings them on. She puts all that there and it goes out to you. If you don't leave reviews, if you don't write things, if you don't share the shows with anybody else, how the heck is she supposed to know that she's actually making a difference? So you need to rate, review, subscribe, and share the show with other people. Let people know about this. but let people know about the show, let them know about all the great guests. She puts the time and energy in. The very least you can do is write a note of appreciation in one of the reviews and let her know that that makes a difference, because this is about changing lives and having impact. So not only give to Sheila by writing that review, but give to your friends. Like, don't hoard the knowledge. Don't hoard the information. Share it with others. Be of service in the world.
Oh, my God. Wow. I think I might just clip that last part off and run it all over the country.
Please do.
Dove Barron, what a wonderful conversation. Thanks a lot, Dove.
Thank you.